Okay, so thanks a lot, Tony. Indeed, I gave a talk on similar subject about 5 years ago, 2004, and in this place, and it was very much liked. So, Tony, is it adjustment you've made? Okay. So anyway, so Tony asked me to give this kind of colloquium again, because new people come to the institute and so on, and also there are some new developments. So for those of you, I just want to make a disclaimer right away. For those of you who heard my talk here 5 years ago, the core, the most of the talk will be very similar. So I apologize for this in advance. But there will be some new developments. And most importantly, I think, we'll be hearing this talk now in a different economic situation, different economic environment than it was 5 years ago. So the same kind of ideas may resonate somewhat differently in the current environment as it was at 5 years ago. Okay. Anyway, so this talk was done, this is basically kind of overview, some broad overview of the work that we did for some maybe last about 10 years. The first paper I published on the subject with a student, Edgar Dragulescu, in European Physical Journal, it's called Statistical Mechanics of Money. And that basically work started quite substantial following. We wrote several papers in between, and many other people followed up. And I can say that by now, this paper became my most cited paper. So I'm not condensed matter physicist anymore. I must be reclassified to that. But anyway, and recently, just last year, I basically wrote a review of the subject, which actually today has been accepted to review of modern physics and available on CondMath. So for those of you who want to read overview, it's I recommend this paper. Okay. So this work was done over many years with different students. These are students, and there's a senior collaborator, Tiziano Di Matteo, he's in Australia, and Barclay Rosser is a distinguished economist at James Madison University. He's actually co-author of this review. Okay. Anyway, so this is an approximate outline of the talk. So I start with some basic theoretical ideas, just to introduce why physicists talk about money, what is in common between statistical physics and money, just theoretical concepts. Then I will briefly touch on this, how this consideration needs to be modified or extended in the case when there is debt, and how debt leads to financial stability and that kind of stuff. This is kind of new development of recent years, not very deeply developed, but nevertheless. Then I'll show a lot of data, empirical data, on two-class structure of income distribution, which kind of support these theoretical ideas, empirical data which support these theoretical ideas. And finally, I will end with some very recent development. This is about distribution not of money wealth, but actual energy wealth, which is, I think, is very fundamental. Anyway, so the first thing, it's good to start a talk with conclusions. So in case people fall asleep or have to leave early, etc. So if you need to remember one thing about this talk, that is it. Do you know where this quote is from? Anybody? Yes, absolutely. Okay, so that is the summary of the talk, okay? So, and how I came across this quote, I actually wanted to do Google search. Who else is doing this kind of research on money and gas? So I put this in Google, and of course, at first hit was Pink Floyd, of course. Okay, anyway, so what is common between money and gas? Well, we have to go back to the end of 19th century, and these are the two Porsches that symbolize that era. One of them, of course, is Ludwig Boltzmann, very well-known physicist, basically one of the founders of statistical mechanics. We, of course, know this very well. Another person is Vilfredo Pareto, who lived at about the same time. And he's a famous economist. He became economist. Even though he was trained as an engineer and actually worked as a director of railroads in Italy, he became interested in social subjects. Particularly, he started to collect social statistics, like data on distribution of income, wealth, etc. And he being trained as an exact scientist, he put this data, wanted to find what is the law that describes the data. And he found that these distributions of income, wealth, and these kind of things are described by power law. And this power law is known since in economics and social sciences as Pareto law. For the purpose of this talk, Pareto law, well, is power law, okay? At the same time, we all know that Boltzmann and other founders of statistics, Big Gibbs and so on, they established that another very fundamental law of probability in statistical physics, which is exponential law. We know this as Boltzmann-Gibbs probability distribution, which basically says that probability to find system with energy epsilon is the exponential function of energy epsilon. And because energy is dimensional, we have to divide by some parameter of dimensionality of energy, which we call temperature, okay? And so these two laws were established, and throughout the talk, there will be interplay, a lot of interplay between these things. So the basic idea that how I started, how I get into this field, the basic idea I started from was a certain analogy between distribution of energy and distribution of money. Okay, so that is a starting point. Let me explain how what is the idea behind it. Okay, let's consider first very briefly remind you how it works in statistical physics. Well, if we consider a gas like molecules in the air in this room, yes. What is money? Okay, let me. This will be second half of the slides. Let me get to second. Yes. Well, income will be even second part of the talk. So let me deal with money first. In the first part of the talk, I will deal with money first. No, right, this is an introduction. This is introductory slides. Okay? So first I'll discuss money. I'll discuss this in some detail. And then second part we'll get to income. But let's hold on to income for a moment until we get to it. And money will appear in the second half of the slide. But let me very briefly remind physics situation. So what is physics situation? Physics situation is the following. How we derive Boltzmann-Gibbs distribution of energy in physics? Roughly, I mean, several different derivations, more or less giving the same result. Let's consider a collision between atoms. Okay, so two atoms, one atom is energy epsilon 1, another one is epsilon 2, they collide, okay? And then they fly away after collision. And some amount of energy delta epsilon is transferred from one atom to another atom, okay? So there is conservation of energy in this collision. So the sum of energies of these two atoms before and after collision is the same. So we have conservation of energy in binary collisions between atoms, okay? And then imagine you have a huge number of atoms, they collide repeatedly, you know, randomly, stochastically, etc. And so they develop some sort of, but if you wait long enough, they will come to some sort of statistical equilibrium. They develop some kind of probability distribution of energy, and we want to know what is that stationary probability distribution of energy. We want to know the functional form of it, okay? And there are several ways of deriving it, and one way is the following, from detail balance. It says that let's consider a number of transitions from this initial state to that state. So the rate of these transitions will be the probability of making this transition times the occupation number of this state and occupation number of that state. Okay, so this rate of transition from here to here. But you can also consider reverse situation, reverse transitions from this configuration, that configuration. It will be proportional to these probabilities times the occupation number of this state, let's say final states. When we are in stationary state, well, one way to achieve it is when these two fluxes balance each other, so we write a stationary distribution. Now, in physics, this fundamental law, which is time reversal symmetry. We can reverse time, you can run moving backwards, and it works very well. So for this reason, these probabilities of transition from this configuration to that and vice versa, they're exactly equal. We can cancel them out. Now we are left with two very simple equations, okay, which can be summarized like this. Energy is additive, probability is multiplicative. So the question, what is the solution of these two equations? The answer is solution is exponential function. If P is exponential function of epsilon, then second equation is identically satisfied if the first equation is satisfied. End of derivation, okay? Now, and you see this probability distribution is very universal. It actually does not depend on details of the rules of the model. All these dynamics of the model is encoded into this transition Ws, but they cancel out. Okay, so stationary distribution doesn't depend on that. That's the power of equilibrium statistical physics. Distribution actually does not depend on details, so we can apply it to lots of different things. And there are various other derivations. For example, one of them I'd like to mention is by maximization of entropy. Another way of deriving this, we can say, okay, we have an ensemble of atoms. We distribute energy between them. We can distribute energy in different ways, okay? And there is something called multiplicity. The same distribution, the same histogram, can be obtained by moving different atoms into different bins and make permutations. And then we ask, the logarithm of multiplicity is called entropy. It's basically how many combinatorial quantity, how many ways you can produce given histogram. And we say, we want to find the most probable histogram. That is, we want to maximize entropy, that is distribution of energy between different bins, subject to constraint the total energy is conserved. And it's very well known, Lagrange multiplier, etc. We do this maximization, we arrive to the same exponential distribution. And so on. This is all very well known to physicists. It's a very brief refresher, okay? And now we come to money. What we want to do, we want to replace energy with money, okay? Let me first explain operationally what I mean by this, and then we'll discuss what is the meaning, what is the definition of this money. Now, let's consider a transaction between economic agents. Let's say we have a bunch of people in this room, and each of us have some cash in the pockets, okay? And we want to make some economic transactions. So some people produce something like make coffee and sell this coffee to somebody. So this person, agent number two, buys some coffee or whatever from agent one. And this agent two pays money delta M for that coffee. So delta M, this money, a certain amount of money delta M is transferred from one agent to another, okay? So this transfer of money in binary transactions look similar to transition transfer of energy in binary collisions. Okay, and as we see, the sum of money, the sum of those cash that one person paid to another, the sum of money of these two people before and after transaction is the same, because money was only transferred from one person to another. Okay? Yes. Now. Yes. 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 Okay. Yes. Yes. Right. Okay. Absolutely. Mm-hmm. Yes. 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 Absolutely. Absolutely. Federal Reserve has. Yes. Okay. Yes. And absolutely, Federal Reserve has the power by law to print money, basically to produce money. So by open operation, Federal Reserve can inject money into the market and withdraw money from the market. So Federal Reserve is a very special central agent. Yes. But just let's finish with this one. Yes, yes, let's finish with this one. So, of course, there may be central source of money, central bank, central government. They have monopoly of creating money. That's certainly true. In physics, the same story. We can have sources of energy. For example, we consider the Earth. Earth receives energy from the sun. So energy comes from the sun to the Earth. So in other words, in physics, we start with idealization of a closed system, okay, and do equilibrium thermodynamic, equilibrium statistical physics first for closed system, and then we'll try to generalize to open system, where system can receive energy from outside, and of course it will be not necessarily at equilibrium, there will be fluxes and so on. Okay, so in other words, influx of money from external source can be accommodated in the problem. In physics, we also have this. It's not a problem, it's just a question of flux across the boundary, that's what we call it, okay? And in physics, we start with idealization of closed system. Well, you know, no system is truly in equilibrium. You know, everything is really not in equilibrium. But we start with the idealization. Let's close system and see, let's agent interact. Let's for a moment, consider that Fed does not inject money like every day, and ask what would be the distribution if no central sources print money every day. And that's a very good question, okay? And there will be equilibrium. And economists have plenty of millions of papers about economic equilibrium, which, of course, no real economic system is in equilibrium. You know, if you ask a real system, you know, is American economy equilibrium? Of course not. And yes, tons of papers are written about economic equilibrium. What I'm trying to propose is statistical equilibrium. This is a rather idealized concept, but it doesn't mean that it cannot be discussed. Okay, yes. Okay. Okay. Okay, first of all, maybe you should explain the difference to the audience. What is the difference between M0, M1, M2, M3? Okay, so what is M1? M1 is money that you have in a pocket cash, you know, paper cash, and money deposited in checking accounts. Okay? Now, M2 is the same as M1, plus money deposited in saving accounts, money manager accounts, and such. Now, I'd like to ask people in the audience, do you really care whether your money located in checking account or saving in money manager account? I personally don't care at all. I have all these accounts. I have checking, money manager, saving accounts. I really don't care. I count all of this as my money. In other words, pretty much most people you know in the room know actually very well how much money they have. These are money they have in the pocket in cash and in their bank accounts. They receive paycheck. They know how much they receive. This is deposited in the bank account, whatever is the account. Okay? And then they spend this money goes out. If you ask my wife, she knows very precisely how much money I have, and most people do as well. No, not stock and bonds. Non-stock and bonds. Stock and bonds are separate. That's a separate category. Why? Because if I want to buy coffee, okay, if I go to cafeteria, I have one coffee, they ask me to pay cash. They would not accept stocks, they would not accept bonds. They demand cash. Okay? If I short on cash, I may want to sell stocks to somebody who will give me cash and then money, and then I'll use this cash to buy coffee. Okay? So that's the definition. Yes. 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 Okay.
Next to spend time researching that.
Right.
That
Okay, that's not what economists are interested in, right? That's not insignificant. Okay, so let me make qualifier. This talk, yes, right. Okay, let me make clarifier. This talk, I mean, let me make it from the very beginning, because this talk will be about very trivial and very insignificant subject. Okay, that is, I mean, I admit this right away. And the point is, what the subject is about. I receive salary from my department. You know, there is salary committee, etc. This is cash. This is in this insignificant category. I personally do not have any stocks. I don't have any bonds. All I have is what my department pays me. I deposit in my department. And I use this to spend, I use this to travel, etc. And I think this is the situation that applies to majority of people in this room. Yes, there is a certain fraction of the people who have bonds, stocks, and everything. But this fraction, wait, yes, pension funds, that's a good point. But I cannot go and buy coffee using my 401k account. But my 401k account is locked. It's not available to me. Yes, I do contribute cash there, but it's locked, not available to me. What is available to me in everyday house? Same story. I cannot use my house to buy coffee. Okay, because I can use only my salary. Yes, I can borrow. You can say borrow. Now we come to key borrowing. We come to key issue debt. And that is absolutely key issue debt. That's something we haven't mentioned yet. Because when we discuss this consideration in a moment, we'll have to specify boundary conditions on this money M. Okay, in the initial consideration, this money will be considered positive. Positive means the initial consideration debt will not be allowed. In other words, if somebody spends all the money, balance is zero, that's it. You cannot buy anything. You can get money from somebody, get paid, but you cannot spend. So in the initial consideration, the boundary condition will be M equals zero, no debt. And then the next step, I will discuss how it changes if we allow debt, okay? Because debt is really big issue, no question about it. But again, we start with the realization of simple things first and then go to more complicated, okay? So now, with these qualifiers, that we consider money which is basically conserved in this binary transaction, and money cannot go negative, has to stay positive, then we have a well-defined question, what is the stationary probability distribution of money in this kind of idealized system? Whether it corresponds to reality or not, it's a separate question, but this is a model. Yeah. Yes. Yes. Right. Okay. Day. Yes. Okay. Okay. Now, I don't personally buy any bonds from Federal Reserve. And most people, I believe, also don't do. Okay? No. Well, why? Exactly. That's... Yes. Yes. Ah, that is a good question. That is a really good question, right? Because, right, right, absolutely. I cancel them out in physics, right? I cancel out in physics, but in economics, there's no fundamental time of symmetry whatsoever. Yes, in fact, there's strong irreversibility. When we get money from one place, from another place. Okay, so there's no reason to assume it. However, it's not so simple. Because remember, if as far as distribution of money is concerned, what really matters is whether those transition probabilities explicitly depend on money balances. Okay? Let me give an example. When people spend this money, they pay price. I mean, they buy a product and pay the price. Now, if that price is the same for everybody, in other words, the price you pay does not depend how much, what is the money balance, then this kind of rule is effectively time reversible. Okay? Because, I mean, but the problem is, we want to avoid Maxwell's demon. If you have discrimination on the basis of your balance, in other words, the price we charge you depends on how much money you have. That is like Maxwell's demon. You can discriminate molecule and, you know, violate all this Boltzmann-Gibbs thing. But if the price you pay is independent of how much you have, everybody pays the same price when they make transaction, then in fact, transition probabilities do not depend on money balance explicitly, and so that equation still holds. Okay, yeah. Maybe, you know, I should, but bottom line, there is a class of model. There is a class of model, which are not unreasonable models, where this time reversal symmetry effectively works, effectively applies. And there is a class of models where this time reversal symmetry does not apply, and, you know, and you get some different distribution. So example of this reversible situation, I'll show a simulation in a moment, where people pay the same price, in this case, like $1. Every transaction, let's take $1. Okay, because it's $1 this way and $1 that way, effectively it's time reversible. It does not depend on the money balance. The alternative rule is people pay, like, say, fixed percentage, like 1% of their balance. The person who pays like 1% of the person balance. If you try to reverse it, you will not reverse it because it will be 1% of the other person balance, so you'll get different results. But if it's $1 forward, $1 backward, you get the same. Or if balance goes up by $1, goes by one, down by $1, you get the same. But if it goes 1% up, 1% down, you don't get the same. So that's roughly the idea. Yeah. So basically, additive kind of rules, they are reversible generally. And multiplicative rules generally not reversible. That's roughly the rule. Yes. Yes, absolutely. 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 In fact, you consume coffee and coffee disappears. Exactly. So point is, behind, you know, in this kind of approach, I focus only on one part of an aspect of the economy. That is the flow of money. Of course, there is corresponding flow of goods which are produced, consumed, you know, etc. And that's very, you know, that has, you know, infinite number of dimensions and, you know, very difficult to keep track of all that coffee, etc. But it's relatively much easier to keep track of money. So point is, I only keep track of money. And I don't keep track of what exactly it was paid for coffee or for bread or whatever it is. Yes. No, that's true. Okay. Yes. Yes. We actually did simulation. Yes. Okay. Yes. Yeah, okay. Mm-hmm. Right. Absolutely. Yes. Yeah, absolutely. This is a very good example. I buy gold today. So what I do, I have some money. Now I give this money to somebody who had gold, so I don't have money anymore, I have a piece of gold. 5 years later, I try to sell this gold to somebody else, and somebody else will give me some amount of money. And the amount of money received will generally be different, there is no question, okay? But the point is, to sell this gold, somebody has to give me this money. So somebody has to have this money, okay? So if you eliminate this virtual particle of gold, what you see is you have some transaction extended in time. So you had money first, then you gave this money to somebody else, then later you received money from somebody else. You had basically three body or whatever, or four body interaction with transfer of money between three or four agents that were involved in the, you know, handling this gold. But in the end, money was transferred between people who were handling gold. The amount of money which was transferred around the gold is exactly the same, if you think about it. Yes.
It's half an hour into one hour.
Yeah, okay. Yeah. So, yes, move on.
More
okay. Okay, that's a good idea. Well, anyway, let me show you a simulation of how it works. Let's consider it. Let's do a, you know, agent-based simulation, which is very popular in economics these days, in some parts of economics these days. Okay, let's consider, we have some bunch of agents, and initially, some 500, whatever, it's a big number of agents, and give them initially the same amount of money. So initially, everybody has like 10 units of money. And then they start to make economic transactions, somebody pays to somebody, etc. And we see what happens to this distribution. In this case, rules are extremely simple. Every transaction is one unit, $1, okay? But it's done randomly. So of course, physicists all know the result. Okay, so that's what you get. Initially, you had delta function distribution. Everybody had the same money. Then delta function starts to broaden. Because obviously, because of transactions, some people have more money, some people have less money. And it broadens some kind of Gaussian manner. You see the bell curve. And it's diffusion, very well-known diffusion. And if you keep running simulations, spread. But then you see something interesting starts to happen. Boundary condition. You see, we said there is a boundary condition that money cannot go below zero. If you spend all the money, that's it. You cannot spend any more. So m equals zero is impenetrable boundary condition. Probability cannot penetrate beyond it. but heat penetrates this way, the positive side. So it becomes asymmetric. It used to be Gaussian symmetric, but becomes now asymmetric. And if you keep running the simulation, it becomes more and more distorted. Basically, probability accumulates at the low end because probability cannot penetrate here and keeps propagating this way. And eventually, it will stabilize. Unfortunately, I can't get rid of this thing. But what's plot here is entropy. Entropy increases and saturates, and eventually this distribution approaches to exponential distribution shown by this red curve. And eventually, after if you wait long enough, it will be stationary. It will be sitting on this exponential distribution. It will not change it anymore, even though agents keep transferring money, etc. You know, if I put here instead of money, but energy will be exactly what we have in physics, I just replace label. That's all I did. So it's all very, very familiar. So point is, at least in some, and you can make model somewhat more sophisticated. You can use some, you know, more sophisticated rules and play more with this kind of models. But anyway, but this is basically an idea of what we're talking about. Kind of probability distribution that originates in the system. And by the way, there are some economics papers, for example, by Miguel Molica, who is an economist who actually did similar kind of simulations and obtained similar distributions, maybe different functional form, but that's not the point. Point is, there is some standard distribution we want to discuss. Okay? So, that kind of, this kind of curve gives a mini conclusion to the first part of four. The basic idea about statistical distribution. The proposal is that if you have a closed system, this conserved amount of money, and money randomly distributed between agents, and certain time reversal conditions are satisfied, then in equilibrium, statistical equilibrium, you would expect to see exponential probability distribution of money with some characteristic temperature, which is nothing but I call it money temperature, average money per person. Okay, that's a rather trivial conclusion, actually. The next step will be that. So, we decided not to take questions, but yes, let's move on to the next part, that. That is very, very important. Okay, that issue was raised. Okay, so what is that? Now let's consider a person who has no money, I mean, spend all the money, or doesn't have enough money to make a transaction. Then this person can, in principle, go and borrow money. Now let's look very carefully what happens in the act of borrowing money. You go to a bank, you get a loan. Suppose your balance was zero initially, okay? You borrow money from the bank. You get two things. You get money, you know, you get cash, whatever, from the bank, positive, and now you can go and buy coffee. But you also have debt. You also have debt obligation. You have liability. So in the balance sheet, you have positive and negative entries. So your net worth, your debt, your money, your assets and liabilities are still equal to zero. So essentially, just borrowing money is like creating particle antiparticle pairs. You create a pair of positive and negative money. Negative money is debt, and positive is what I had. And then you go and spend your money, buy coffee, so your positive money, you know, balance decreases, but debt stays with you. Your liabilities are still there. So your net balance becomes negative. Okay? So in other words, by allowing debt, we essentially relax this boundary condition and allow people to have, you know, agents to have negative money. Okay? And now you can ask how this distribution would change if you mess up this boundary condition. You know, this in physics, the boundary condition is extremely important because this is ground state energy. This is the state with lowest possible energy. And if you relax it and let system go into more negative states, then you're up for a big trouble. It's like roughly like introducing a black hole in the system. Then energy is unbounded from below, and then there is no stabilization. If you consider an idealized case where, say, people can borrow money unlimitedly. If you need money, you borrow money. You know, credit is plenty, you know, available. Then, effectively, it means there is no boundary condition, meaning money balance could go negative, 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 no, without restriction, okay? So in this case, obviously, the simulation, starts with delta function, Gaussian broadening, will keep broadening and broadening and broadening and broadening. It will never stabilize. If you do not have a boundary condition on this side, distribution will never stabilize. More and more people will be getting in debt, further and further in debt, and to counteract this, some people will be getting extremely rich. Because, again, because conservation is still satisfied, except that now the variable m can take negative values. So that means the first moment of this distribution, in other words, the center of mass, if you like, of this distribution, it stays in the same place. And as the population on the negative side grows, correspondingly, this population on the positive side grows. In other words, some people will be getting very high positive balances at the expense of some people getting very high negative balances. This is one of the recipes how to get rich. You know, put somebody else in debt. Okay. Now, when we of course recognize the situation, you know, early on, you know, right away. But being physicists, we thought, well, there must be some boundary condition. You know, it doesn't make any sense. People, you know, getting unlimited debt, you know, it just doesn't make any sense. System will be unstable. It will be no disaster. So there must be some sort of boundary condition imposed. So that's what we did. We imposed some, we tried very simple-minded models. Okay, sorry, I should go forward. So we tried to impose some boundary conditions on debt. Okay, so first idea was very simple-minded, not realistic, absolutely not realistic, but nevertheless. We said, okay, let's people borrow up to some limit, like you have credit card limit, okay, up to 800 units, okay? And then run simulation. When we run simulation, that's what we get. Before that, the boundary condition was at zero, we had this exponential. If you allow them to borrow up to 800, we get another exponential distribution just with a new boundary. Simply by allowing people to go up to some limit, well, we just shift the boundary condition. Okay, and get new exponential distribution. And the temperature increase, remember, temperature is average amount of money per person, it basically increased from, well, whatever it was, to by 800 units. Because effectively, by allowing people to go in debt up to this limit, you basically give them this money, make them available. And so you get new temperature. But this, of course, is not really very realistic because it's not like there is uniform debt limit everywhere. And there was a proposal made by Chinese researchers, by Chinese econophysicists. They pointed out that perhaps more realistic condition is a constraint on the total debt in the system. Okay? Not individual debt, but total debt in the system. And in fact, there is a good argument which actually follows from textbooks of economics. This is presented in every undergraduate economic textbook, something called required reserve ratio. The required reserve ratio is basically the following. Now we introduce banks, okay? So people put money in the bank, and bank now lend this money. So people come and go and borrow this money from the bank. So in this way, the same money, you know, kind of multiplies. It goes many times because same amount of money was deposited, was lended to somebody, that person deposited and lended, etc. So it starts to multiply. If you let it go like this, it can multiply to infinity. In other words, that means there is no condition on the growth of debt. However, there is a mechanism called required reserve ratio. The banks, at least, retail banks, the banks that deal with, you know, retail customers, they are required by law to set aside certain portion of deposits and not lend it anymore, just keep it in reserve. In this way, you get convergent geometrical progression because every time less money becomes available for lending, and this progression converges, and you get a finite so-called money multiplier, okay? So bottom line, if this system with required reserve ratio and debt is, you know, maxed to the maximal possible amount, then you have basically a certain amount of debt in the system, negative money and positive money. And then you ask what kind of distribution you will get. Not very surprising, but you get exponential both ways. You got exponential distribution positive way and exponential distribution negative way. So this is a stable and stable and still exponential in some way distribution. Okay. So, however, then we were criticized by some economists who pointed out that in fact this required reserve ratio is really enforced inconsistently. Inconsistently meaning it is required from some certain kind of bank, but not required from the other. For example, commercial companies are not subject to this regulation. And some countries like Australia do not have required reserve ratio at all. So there are plenty of cases when this thing simply doesn't exist. And so point is this mechanism is not really, practically speaking, not really effective in limiting debt. And so, practically speaking, debt can grow unlimitedly. And we are back to this original problem. Because if debt can grow unlimitedly, then we don't have any stationary equilibrium in the system. Okay? And moreover, there is no obvious. I mean, there is a question: is there any mechanism for limiting debt? Because apparently there is no apparent limiting mechanism for limiting debt. And for this reason, there is no such thing as equilibrium debt. Okay. So if debt is permitted unlimitedly, the system will just grow like this. Okay. And which is pretty much happening now. I mean, which has pretty much happened in the recent years. Okay. So that's kind of how this kind of framework of thinking connects with recent developments in the actual financial system. Okay. Now, I maybe I wanted to say more about that, but time is short. Maybe I'll move to the next part of the talk, which is the third part, and this is about income. Okay, because thus far it was all theoretical simulation, theoretical ideas which may or may not, you know, work, or who knows whether they. Yes. 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 Next slide. Next slide. Yes. Yeah. Two slides down. Okay, so let's move on to, because this power law was mentioned, et cetera. Anyway, we basically, you know, we played with this very simple, very naive theoretical ideas in year 2000, you know, wrote a paper, so what. I mean, but then, you know, we started, being physicists, we wanted to say, what about the data? You know, we started to compare, we tried to compare with the data. Now, the problem is, it's very difficult to find data on distribution of money, I mean, money balances, because, you know, there's no requirement for people to report how much money you have every day, et cetera. So it's difficult to collect this data. Maybe possible, but very difficult. But on the other hand, there is plenty of data on distribution of income, because people pay taxes and they have to report. You have like 100 million or so tax returns every year. There's a huge amount of data available, and this is analyzed by government and so on and so forth. There's plenty of data available. So we say, let's look at this data empirically. Now, of course, income is not the same as money, because income is like flux of money. So in physics language, it would be like power as opposed to energy. You know, flux of money per unit time, per year. So it's not the same thing. And also, people don't trade incomes like, you know, you and me meet, we trade some portion of our incomes. It doesn't work that way. So surely that model, that original inspirational model, they're not quite, does not apply directly to income, okay? So, you know, I don't want to impose it. But let's just look now, switch gears, and look just on empirical data on distribution of income without particular theoretical, you know, bias, okay? Let's just look at the data and just discuss what it is. So we can look at the data, and data is from IRS, because there's plenty of data at IRS, it's all publicly available, you just download it, you get it. And what we observed immediately is the following, two-class society, okay? So what we found is in the lower part of the distribution, is described by exponential functions. How we see this? You plot it log linear scale. I should say this is cumulative probability distribution, the integral. Number of people, percentage of people who have income above certain level of income, okay? And for exponential, it's also exponential. So, this is logarithmic scale for probability, and this is linear scale for income. This is up to $100,000 per year adjusted gross income. In this range between zero to 100 or so $1,000 per year, distribution follows a straight line. Straight line in log linear scale. Straight line log means exponential. So, for the lower part of people with income, you know, not too high income, distribution is exponential, okay? On the other hand, if you look at very high income, this is $1 million per year, $1,000 per year, and you plot this now in log-log scale, it becomes straight line in log-log scale. That means power law, okay? So distribution really consists of two very distinct parts. Lower part is exponential, and upper part is Pareto. So this both Boltzmann and Pareto, they both were right. Both things are present, okay? But we have two-class society. We can define operationally the boundary between classes. It's simply the point where two fits intersect. This is just operational definition of classes. Lower class, there are only two classes, lower class and upper class. If you tell me there is middle class, I don't know where to put this boundary. This is, you know, all the way from 100K to zero. And I don't see any features where to put boundary between, you know, truly lower class and middle class. Okay, just only two classes, okay? Now, lower class, as I said, is characterized by exponential law. Now, let's count how many people in upper Pareto. Now, how many people are in the upper class? Okay, this is log scale, and this intersection point, it's cumulative. And look what is the number. It's 1, 2, 3. It's about 3%. So about 3% of population belong to the upper class. And the majority, 97%, belong to the lower class. So the first part of my talk was about things that are relevant for 97% of population who don't buy bonds from Federal Reserve. And you know, and all these things about 23% who actually buy, you know, bonds and that kind of stuff. Okay, I'm talking about majority. My primary interest, majority of population, people here. But Pareto was talking about people there. Okay, that's basically the resolution. And by the way, this kind of distributions are known in physics as well. This is called thermal. It's called super thermal. In plasma physics, astrophysics, etc., cosmic rays, and so on. This kind of distributions are rather common. Now, this data is only for 1 year, for particularly 97. You might ask, is it stable? How it changes in different years? Okay, so we look for data for about 20 years. Where is it? 83-2001. Okay, now, in this case, of course, average income changes in time. And average income, remember, is like temperature in the exponential function. So we had to normalize. We had to, for each year, for every year, we made the plot in log linear scale, determine the slope of that straight line. That gives us the temperature, income temperature, and normalize income to, I can call it income temperature, which is nothing but average income in the exponential part. After this rescaling, all points collapse based on the same curve. So this data is log-log scale for 80s and 90s. And see the lower part, points basically collapse, this is just shifted for clarity. They basically collapse on the same curve. So what you find is that exponential part is extremely stable. I mean, distribution, shape of distribution is extremely stable. Temperature changes, yes. You know, average income doubled from about 20K in 83 to about 40K in 2001. But it only changes the scale. The shape doesn't change. So from physics point of view, it looks like thermal equilibrium, like thermal bath. I mean, something of huge, you know, hugely stable. On the other hand, the upper tail, the Pareto tail, is not stable. It changes. It doesn't rescale. So it changes significantly over the last 20 years. In fact, I'll show you data in a moment. There was substantial, tremendous growth of the upper tail, income in the upper tail. So, but Lee, I'll get to this a few slides later, because the question was about mechanism, et cetera. Why is this? Why we have this two-class distribution? Well, we can look more closely. Since this American IRS data, well, this particular set of data doesn't tell us what is the origin of that income. However, in principle, this is possible to find data to check what is the origin. Particularly, I get some really good, interesting data from Sweden, from some people in Sweden. So this is, again, income in Sweden, log-log scale. The red curve is the total income, okay? But this total income is divided into components, okay? So the circles are work, means like salaries and wages. And this is this curve, okay? And you see for the lower part of population, it's salary, it's work, labor income that dominates the income, okay? The other thing crosses is capital, and this is actually this one. It goes here. And for the upper tail, this is capital, those bonds from Federal Reserve, they dominate income. But only for this portion of population. For this portion of population, it's just wages and salaries that dominate income. And then there is also social transfer, like social security assumption, for really lower part of the distribution. So bottom line, there are two different sources of income. I mean, and then naturally we have different distributions, okay? So now once we realize this, we can try to characterize mathematically the next slide, you know, to write some equations to describe this. As we said, there are different sources of income for the upper and lower class. Salaries and wages for lower, capital gains, investments, and so on for the upper class. Now, and I'm going to propose that we can describe them by so-called additive and multiplicative dynamics. Additive multiplicative diffusion. That directly relates to this Alyosha thing. From social point, if you want to be a little bit more social, you know, you can think of it like employees and employers, you know, if you want to go into really, you know, class, social classes. But this can be also simulated, you know, in a computer. It was really interesting work done by Ian Wright, who is a computer scientist. He basically did agent-based simulation. I showed you very primitive agent-based simulation. He did more sophisticated simulation with more sophisticated rules. And his simulation, he observes emergence of these two classes from initially equal agents. So in principle, if you put more sophisticated rules, you can see emergence of these two classes. And this is also, I would say, you can think of this also like ecology, you know, like employees need employers and employers need employees. You can think of this like from an ecological point of view, if you like. But anyway, but now let me do very, very simple mathematical attempt to do mathematical description. How we can get mathematical these kind of things? Well, let's introduce some dynamics in the model. Let's introduce income dynamics, okay? And let's say income changes by some amount delta R, because income changes, goes up, goes down, etc. And if it changes small for your period of time, then we can write some sort of Fokker-Planck equation, basically write like diffusion equation, which is very standard. It basically describes time evolution of probability distribution of income R as a function time t. And the right-hand side contains basically two terms, first and second derivative in income. And the coefficients A is the first moment of income change, and B is the second moment of income change. This is very standard now, very general, called Kolmogorov equation, mathematics, and so on. Okay, and then we ask for a stationary solution. Because we want to consider system in equilibrium, it's time, we set time derivative to zero, and this must be equal to zero, and solution of this equation is stationary solution, easy to obtain. But it depends on some assumptions. First, let's make an assumption that for lower class, income changes are independent of income. In other words, when somebody gets promoted, there is a raise by a certain amount of dollars, but it's not percentage, it's fixed dollars or demoted. In this case, coefficients A and B here are independent of R because they're just constant. So in B a constant, you solve this equation, you get exponential. So once you have additive diffusion, which is in some sense is time reversible or no Maxwell demon, you get exponential distribution for income. Now we're talking about income, okay? On the other hand, for the upper class, it makes reasonable to think that it goes multiplicative. Whatever changes in proportion. You know, stocks goes up and down, whatever, everything goes in proportion. In this case, coefficients A and B are proportional to linear first and second power of R. You plug into this equation, you get power law. Okay? So if it's dynamics multiplicative, you get power law. If it's additive, you get exponential. That's simple. Okay, now, this was a conjecture. However, it was actually verified to some degree by the data. To verify it, you need to know data on income changes, which is called income mobility. This data not so easy to get, possible, but you know, not easily available publicly, except for Japan. In Japan, it turns out that for the upper tail, for the top taxpayers, this data is available, meaning agency actually publishes every year names of top taxpayers with their incomes, addresses, and everything. Okay? Yeah, so you can track the same people from year to year, but only for the top, only for the upper tail. Okay, not for the millions of people. And then you can track them and actually make a statistics of probability, you know, income changes. And then these people actually, I believe one of them was actually string theory sometimes in the past. They're from Kyoto University. But anyway, so they basically looked at this data and verified that indeed it is multiplicative for the upper class. Okay, but now let's take it a little bit one step further. You know, one can have both additive and multiplicative. For example, you get cost of living adjustment, which is in percentage, and merit raise, which is in additive. You can have both. In this case, you have this kind of coefficients. You plug them into equation, you get this kind of distribution, which looks a little bit complicated, arctangents, etc. But in fact, it's very simple. It just interpolates between exponential and power law at two ends, and are not this crossover. Okay. So basically, you get this kind of distribution has interpolation between exponential power law and are not the parameter income with boundary where you make crossover. And this is fit of IRS data in this form, which works actually reasonably well. Okay, and now I finally come into, you know, one more thing. Gini coefficient. Well, maybe I skip Gini coefficient. No, no? Okay. There's the central point.
No, I proposed both. Mm-hmm. Why don't we, since there were a lot of questions, mm-hmm. When the hour is over, we'll allow the people
yeah,
who
okay,
want
good,
to leave.
Yeah, okay, good. Absolutely, absolutely, absolutely. Already, yes, absolutely. And some people already left.
After you finish it, probably can ask questions.
Absolutely, absolutely. And some people already left, so this is a really good idea. So, good idea, I mean. Anyway, so okay, a couple things about, yes, Lorentz curve and Gini curve, because this is standard ways to derive, describe inequality in economic literature. So first of all, Lorentz curve, which was proposed by economist Lorentz at the beginning of the 20th century. The point is the following. When I make those plots, I necessarily truncate my axis somewhere. You know, I extend my plot up to some income, maybe $1 million, but still finite income. It would be nice to fit all the data, you know, up to infinity in the finite piece of paper, okay? And this is the way to do it. So Lorentz curve is a curve defined parametrically. There is horizontal coordinate x and vertical coordinate y, and they're defined in the following way. So we pick some parameter r, some income r. So x is the fraction, the cumulative probability, the fraction of people with income below r. Okay. And what is y? Y is total income of those people who have income below r. Okay. So now you change this parameter r from 0 to infinity, and you get a curve that goes from 0.00 to 0.11. You start from no people, no income, and then you exhaust all the people, 100% of people, and 100% of income in the system. You get some sort of curve connecting these two points. Okay. And this curve is called Lorentz curve. Okay. Now, there is also another concept which is called Gini coefficient. So what is Gini coefficient? One Gini claim pointed out, also Italian economist, pointed out that the deviation of the actual curve from diagonal is a certain measure of inequality in the system. Because if people had the same income, then income would be proportional to people, so you get straight line, diagonal. Any deviation from this line is a certain measure of inequality. So he proposed to take the area between this diagonal and the actual curve, normalized to the area of triangle, and this is called Gini coefficient. This is a number that characterizes inequality. Okay, it's very, very commonly used, very standard. Now, if we assume that probability distribution is exponential, okay, we can plug exponential here, take integrals, and explicitly calculate Lorentz curve. Okay, so this is the formula which is, you know, not difficult to obtain. This explicit formula for Lorentz curve in the case if probability distribution of income is exponential, and this is shown by the red curve. Notice that this curve has no fitting parameters. It's not a fit, no fitting parameters, just a curve. Red curve and the red squares are actual data from IRS for year 1983. So what we observed is, you know, 25 years ago, the distribution of income was actually pretty close to exponential. Well, there was in fact even above, I mean even a little bit less inequality was there. However, as the time progressed from 83 to 2000, the curve has shifted. You see, red curve shifted to blue curve, shifted down, okay? And ask why shifted down? Well, it's actually very easy to explain why it shifted down. Because of the tail. Remember that there is this power of the Pareto tail. And this is a small fraction of people, few percent of people, who account for a substantial fraction of total income in the system. So essentially, what it produces in this way, it produces a jump. Essentially, once you reach to this power, you have a vertical jump, because big jump in vertical and very small jump in horizontal. So if you incorporate this modification, then you can fit data again. We need to modify this curve. We need to use a coefficient f. F is the fraction of income going to the upper tail, as opposed to exponential part. And then we modify this formula accordingly. Essentially, we just rescale this curve down, and then again fill data very well. So again, essentially the difference, the point of message here is the following. The difference between 83 and 2000 is that the bulk of population is still exponential. Nothing really happened to the bulk of population. What did happen is that enormous growth of income in the upper tail. Okay? And this is all quantitative sky. What about Gini coefficient? For this curve exponential, you can easily calculate Gini, and this it happens to be 1/2. You know, just take integrals, you get 1/2. This is the baseline, 1/2. Okay? And the blue point is Gini coefficient as calculated by IRS, as reported by IRS. And what we see first, Gini coefficient is not very far from 1/2. But second, if you look closer, it's increasing. It's increasing over time. And look at this. It was slightly below 1/2, but then it was a peak. What is peak? 87. What is 87? Crash of stock market. Then stock market crashed, went down. Then it was kind of flat. Around 95, so on, started to increase sharply. Sharp increase of Gini coefficient since 95. Sharp increase of inequality since 95. The boom, this dot-com boom, growth of inequality. And then what happened in 2000? Stock market crashed. So stock market crashed, the tail started to shrink and started going down. And now I'll show you the data, Morrison. This was a paper published several years ago. Morrison data, we have data all up to year 2006. So I mean Morrison time. Yes. Yes. Yes, I agree. Yeah. Okay. Let's see at this data. Okay. This is more recent data. Okay. Let's see if it makes sense or not. Okay. This is just the data. I mean, this is data. You can make any sense of it you like. Okay. This is just actual data. Okay. So anyway, we can define this coefficient F, fraction of income, going to the upper tail. Actually, there is a very simple formula for it. All you need to do is the following. You can calculate average income of the system. In other words, you take total system in the system, total income in the system, as reported by IRS, divide by total number of people, that's your average income in the system. And then you make a difference with parameter T. T, remember, was the slope of that exponential curve, okay? In other words, is the average income in the exponential part of it. And that difference is basically a certain measure, normalized difference, is a measure how much income goes to the upper tail. Okay? And all these three quantities are plotted here. This is data from IRS, from 83 to 2006. 2006, latest year available now, today. Okay, so a couple of things. First of all, T. Remember, T is average income of, you know, salary people. Okay, you know, people who have exponential. Not much. I mean, in first approximation, straight line. There are some small variations, but in the first approximation, just a straight line. You know, just growth, and most of it just inflation. So no big features, no big jumps, no big peaks. This is the salaries of wages, you know, of the regular people. On the other hand, the black curve is, you know, total, the average income in the whole system. It has peaks. One peak in 2000, another peak in 2006. And if you take the difference, this F, the difference between this, that's what you see. Okay, that income going to the upper part of distribution. And it has enormous peak in the year 2000. 20%. In year 2000, 20% of all income in the system was going to the upper tail. Then crash of stock market. Crash. Then next bubble, housing bubble, again 20% of market going to the upper tail. And of course, we know it crashed. I mean, there's no data yet available, but you know, there's no doubt it crashed after that. Okay? So point is, this income, remember, this is income inequality peaks in the whole society. They are strongly correlated with speculative bubbles in financial market. In other words, this upper tail, just to make a kind of certain, you know, conclusion of some sort, the upper tail is highly non-equilibrium. It expands and contracts, you know, ups and downs with all these bubbles and all these things. So upper tail is highly dynamical. These are all the people who are buying bonds and stocks. On the other hand, 97% of the population sit here. And in the first approximation, nothing much happens to them. I mean, something happens, but of different kind. They may get fired, may get unemployed, you know. But in the first approximation, you know, it's totally different story, okay? So, I think that's about all I want to say about the financial part. There's now the last, fourth part, and this is about real energy. Yes. Or maybe ask short questions about economics.
We'll go to the end of the talk and then we'll pick questions.
Okay, fine. So now let me move on. And one more quote. I started with a quote. I want to show you one more quote. Before I go to energy, I want to show you another quote. Do you know from whom is that quote? Probably not. It's not from Pink Floyd. This is from Harry Dent, okay? The book called The Great One Ahead. The book was published in 1993. That is, you know, 15 years in advance. 15 years in advance, he said that the Great Depression will start year 2008. Well, he also said some other things, 2010, you know. But no, actually, yeah, I mean, there are some caveats. But nevertheless, that's what he said, okay? What is the story about this book? First of all, what do you mean Great Boom? Great Boom, actually, the book, remember, was published during the recession of the old Bush in early 90s, you know, the old Bush. And what Dent was predicting, he was predicting boom of 90s, which indeed happened. And why? What was driving this boom? Baby boomers. Because they were pumping their, you know, retirement savings into stock market. They reached a certain age when they start to really massively pump money. So, and then you do fluxes, you know, I was accused that I am confusing, you know, stocks and fluxes. What I'm saying is there is annual flux of money into stock market. All these pension funds, you know, from my every paycheck, every biweekly. Certain amount of money, actual cash, which I could have used to buy coffee, but I don't. I put this cash and it's pumped into stock market. There is influx of cash into stock market. There's also flux out of stock market. Some people retire, etc. But these fluxes don't balance. I mean, number of people retiring, of course, now is much smaller than people, you know, saving. So there is huge imbalance. So there's huge pump of cash into stock market, which of course drives stock price up. But then times come, 2000 comes. Because this guy, he also discussed what happens, what will happen after the boom. And well, after the boom will happen depression. He, by the way, has a new book published in January, this one. Okay. So point is, then this amount saturates around year 2000, and then it reverses. I mean, and this is coming, year 2010 or so. We have not seen the real big trouble yet. This is only precursors. This peaks, okay? This is just money, you know, not knowing where to go. But then baby boomer starts to retire and withdraw money from stock market, and that will be real, real bad. This is pieces of gold. They all bought pieces of gold. Now they're going to try to sell it to somebody. Everybody will be trying to sell gold, but who's going to buy it? Who's going to have cash to buy that gold? That's the question. And that's basically the origin of, that's the time we live in, okay, right now. And that's really the end of the economic part. And now I want to move to the energy part, okay? Now, however, don't worry. I mean, the current crisis, financial crisis, maybe not the biggest crisis we face. There are more important crises. And this is fossil fuels and global warming, you know. Maybe I just skip it because it's kind of common knowledge. Yeah, point is this, that for a long time, you know, for a long time, for thousands of years, okay, people used muscle, you know, the development of civilization was driven by muscle power, either human or animal. Okay, but then, a couple of centuries ago, humans discovered a great thing. They can utilize fossil fuels, and those fuels accumulate for millions of years, and they can use it. And this binge, and that's when this industrial revolution started and capitalism started. Because I claim that the modern capitalism really started when those machines were made, you know, steam engine, all that stuff, they started to use fossil fuel, because that allowed to, you know, enormously replicate productivity and everything, etc. But now, what now? In a couple of centuries, humans managed to basically spend, pretty much in the first approximation, all the fuel, you know, accumulated for millions of years. And this energy binge comes to the end, okay? How are we going to deal with this? Not that I have any recipes, okay? But I want to show you some little piece of data, which may be relevant and important for, you know, for thinking and discussing this issue, how to deal with it. And this issue is great inequality of energy consumption around the world, okay? So this is data from the World Resource Institute, and this is basically data is like this. You know, you have a list of countries, you have, you know, population of countries, and total energy consumption of the countries. Then we divide one by the other, we get energy consumption per person, it's annualized, so we convert it in kilowatts. So this is energy consumption, kilowatts per person of different countries around the world. I should say we assign the same consumption to all people in the same country. That's why the curve has big jumps. So this is China, this is India, this is United States. Of course, there's variation within the country, but, you know, we don't have data on that. So this is very crude curve, but nevertheless. So basically what it shows, there are some countries like United States where energy consumption is at the level of 10 or 11 kilowatts. The average around the globe is 2 kilowatts, and countries like India consume something like, you know, 0.7 or so kilowatts. So there is great inequality, you know, variation. First of all, this distribution is roughly exponential. The solid curve is exponential. It's not exponential fit. It's not a fit. We just take the average consumption, which defines the temperature, and just make a plot. Doesn't make the, yeah, and it goes through points, you know, reasonably well, given the, you know, given the quality of the data, etc. Okay. And by the way, yes, sorry, I want to mention. By the way, physiological energy consumption of the human is about 200 watts. So humans consume 10 times more than they kind of really need biologically, but that's what the civilization is about. Okay, so point is this, that when we discuss inequality of money or income, we talk inequality of this, greenbacks, pieces of green paper. Some people have more pieces of green paper, some people have less, inequality, but who cares about pieces of paper? Ultimately, it's all about some physical, measures. And I would say that energy is really the relevant physical measure. So inequality of energy consumption is what makes difference between different countries and different levels. And this inequality is, again, roughly exponential, okay? And so that needs to be taken into account, because if you say, we need to consume less or something like that, to whom you're talking? Different participants in the distribution curve have totally different, in different situation, okay? So it's important to keep in mind this great variation. So I said this exponential, I showed this plot in the linear scale, if you like log linear scale, the same data. Interesting story about Gini. This is Lorentz curve for energy consumption per person. Again, the black curve is just for exponential function, okay? And this occurs for different years. So red is in 1990, relatively old data, and the green, 2005, relatively recent data. If you look carefully, you may notice something. I'm not sure if it's really important or not, but I noticed it. If you look at the red curve, first of all, they deviate from black curve, of course. They're not really, truly exponential. But if you look at the red curve, it looks like there's a kink. There's, you may see some sort of a kink here. And this kink, I would say, this is the kink that would separate so-called developing countries, Mexico, Brazil, China, India, from so-called developed countries, Great Britain, France, Australia, Russia, happen to be here, USA. So it's really energy consumption. The level of energy consumption separates so-called developed countries and developing countries. And the kink is relatively sharp in year 1990, okay? But if you go to 2000, the curve seems to move closer toward the exponential curve. See, there is kink is less pronounced if it is there, and the curve is closer. And I think this is speculation, pure speculation, but this may be the effect of globalization. When you really mix everything around the globe uniformly, and when you mix it really, really, really well, what are you going to get? You're not going to get equality. You're going to get exponential inequality. That is a well-mixed physical system. That is distribution in a well-mixed physical system. So don't expect globalization to produce equality in the world. Expect to produce Boltzmann-Gibbs distribution around the world. Okay? And also I wanted to mention that these exponential distributions are actually very, very common in all kinds of things. I discussed money, of course, energy, I discussed something else. But in fact, I came across different discussing ecological communities. It's very common if you have a limited resource. And if you have a limited amount of certain resource, you need to divide between a certain number of players, that's the same as medical problem. And this limited resource may be money, if money is conserved, could be energy, if energy is limitation, could be water, if water is a shortage, could be area, could be surface area, etc. And all these problems with limited resource, constraint on limited resource, you end up with some kind of exponential distribution. Okay, so finally I come to conclusions. And since I took already a lot of your time, I guess I just probably show this. And thank you for your attention. I'll take more questions. Yes. Aha. Uh-huh. Yes, okay. Okay, slide 14, no problem. We'll get slide 14. Slide 14. Okay, this slide, right? So you want to do what?
Purchasing.
Purchasing power. Yes. Interesting question, but we need data. This is data plot. So if I had data, I could have shown it, but I don't have this data. I'm not sure where to get this data. Yes. Oh, yes, one thing I do have, I have inflation. I have this curve, nominal income and inflation. I will show you this. This I do have. Just a second, let me find it. Here. Okay, so this here. This one. So this is same kind of data, just pulled for early, done in previous paper. So the red one is average temperature, increasing more or less linearly, okay? And the blue curve is inflation, consumer price index, okay? And you see these two curves are very close. So in other words, this nominal increase of income, most of it just inflation. It's just renormalization, and it's not really a real thing for the most part, yeah. Yeah. Ah. Yes, very good point. Very good point. This is something, this part of the talk I had to omit because of shortage of time. What I discussed, what I wanted, you know, what I like to discuss is distribution of individual income. That gives exponential, okay? However, lots of data reported for households. And you may ask the following question, just very briefly flash. You may ask, what is the distribution of family income? Okay, if you have two members of the family and both of them earn income, and let's say both incomes are distributed exponentially, what kind of distribution you get for the family? You're gonna use this one. You get distribution which is linear times exponential. Okay, and this is actual data from Bureau of Census for family income for households with two adults, or actually two or more adults. In other words, one should distinguish households with one adult, individual income, or two adults, two income. The shape is different, it does change. Now, this is a problem analyzing data because when data is reported, you know, it's reported in different ways. So it's often mixed. It's often mixed. And this is a problem, but you know, we have the data what we have. Yeah. Yes. Yes. Okay. Right. Okay. Very good point. Remember how in physics we derive this Boltzmann gift? There are different derivations in textbooks. One is I showed binary collisions, okay? Kind of Boltzmann-style kinetic equation, etc. But another derivation, exchange with reservoir. We consider a molecule, individual molecule, exchange with reservoir. And you know, lots of molecules exchange with reservoir, which is, you know, some big mass. And, you know, under certain proper conditions, you also get exponential, okay? So income, similar story. Income of each individual changes up, down, you know, and these changes go to some budget, you know, if there is a, you know, an organization has a budget. So up and down of individual income somehow get collected in some overall budget and get redistributed somehow. So point is, the income story is more like exchange of individuals with a bus, okay? Income, you know, we don't trade incomes pair-wise, but we do trade somehow with some global, you know, kind of budget constraint. And so if conditions are appropriate, like additive rules are additive, there's no Maxwell demon, we end up with the same exponential. That's why it's similar. But if rules are different, if multiplicative, we get power law. Yeah. Yes. Yes. Well, the question is about thermodynamics. I mean, what I present was kind of statistical physics. Of course, we know that there is a counterpart to it, which is thermodynamics. And this, of course, well, what should I say? I did not manage, despite all those years, I did not manage to develop a very good, you know, thermodynamic counterpart to this statistical mechanics picture. Many people tried. I mean, there's lots of literature and lots of economic literature, you know, applying, you know, ideas from thermodynamics to economics. Okay, there's lots of literature on that. But I didn't touch it, and I would rather not touch it. So I would leave it as a future, you know, challenge for somebody else.
More questions?
Yes. Maybe, but, you know, the data is as is. I mean, it's true that there are not too many points here. There are actually, in fact, like 3 points, okay? Only 3 points here, in fact. Why 3 points? Because that's how IRS reports the data. IRS has all of the data, but when they publish the data, they publish only certain levels of income. And that's what we have publicly. So, I mean, there is, you know, there's always a problem with availability of data. So one can think of many interesting games to play, but the data is limited, so maybe.
Just make one comment. Actually, according to your numbers,
yes.
It would seem that most full professors, I don't know about assistant professors,
yes,
are actually in the upper class, rather lower.
I don't know what is the salary scale in this place. You know, in my place, most in my department, most professors belong to lower class. You see, it used to be that our department actually published and provided list of all salaries of all faculty to the all faculty, and I checked this. But okay, so this curve, let's see which one. Yeah, this curve, the black curve. This is actually income are start separating expansion, okay? And year 2000, it was already like 120. In fact, the year 2001 was like 140. And now we're in year 2009, so I don't know what it is. Yeah. So don't.
No more questions. thank you.